Hello listeners and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast that is as popular in Russia as a bargain all-inclusive trip to Salisbury Cathedral. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever to discuss all things sport and doping is Mr. Will Moulton.
Oh God, what are we doing?
Let the hackers come and find us.
To be fair, I don't think we're that important.
Here's hoping. Anyway, so sports news aside, how has life been? Because it's been 3 weeks since we last recorded an episode.
It has been. I went on holiday and then I got stung on the foot by a wasp. And 4 days later, I'm still having an allergic reaction. So I've gone from the highs of life to the lows of life very quickly.
I hope there was more to your holiday than getting stung on foot.
I didn't get stung on holiday.
Oh, okay.
That's been since. No, it was just nice to get away, chill out, forget about hockey for a week. But I'm now back and straight back into hockey.
But chillax time.
Feel a lot more refreshed. How about you?
That's always good. Not so refreshed. People who may have been keeping tabs on my Twitter account would have seen I did a House of Horror, which has destroyed one of my white shirts. Thankfully, I managed to salvage the jumper. But if people want to read what happened to me in that House of Horror, it's on my Twitter and on the Essex Live website. Shameful plug.
Alternatively, they could just go to the House of Horror themselves.
£35 for that per person, so save up. Also, on the day we released the last episode, I went semi-viral for another piece that I did.
Not being big-headed or anything.
No. On my birthday, I got sent to a wood in Billericay,
so
on my
dodgy
patch, because a boa constrictor had been spotted in the area, I think a week or two previously. So my editor kindly sent me down there to see what was going on. Didn't find the boa constrictor, sadly, but there is a terribly embarrassing picture of me next to the warning sign, which got put on the article and also ended up on the Facebook page, Angry People in Local Newspapers. So I went semi-viral.
Your face is now known to millions of people across Essex.
Sadly. Anyway, what have we got for you on today's show? Well, in today's discussion section, it is time to revisit one of our most common topics, Russia and doping, following the news this week that the World Anti-Doping Agency had lifted the suspension of Russia's anti-doping agency after nearly 3 years. A crime against athletes or justified? We will see. Also in today's discussion section, we will talk about the heroics of the incredible Christina Vogel as a cycling champion faces head-on the tragic news that she had been paralysed from the waist down following a training crash. On the feature interview section today, we are joined by a legend of English rugby. She is the second most capped England player of all time, a 2014 World Cup winner and a six-time Six Nations Grand Slam winner. It is the one and only Tamara Taylor. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. WADA? More like WADA load of nonsense. This week in the dreamy sunshine setting of the Seychelles, WADA decided to readmit the Russian anti-doping agency after the biggest doping scandal in history. The decision wasn't exactly a surprise after WADA's Compliance Review Committee recommended the step last week, despite admitting that the assurances of the Russian sports minister fall short of what is required. The decision by the Sir Craig Reedy-led organisation left plenty of people angry. Becky Scott, the chair of WADA's Athlete Commission, resigned. Several athletes voiced their discontent, including the likes of Adam Peaty, Callum Skinner, plus our former guests Laura Dees and Beth Dobbin, and that's only scratching the surface of the reaction. The UK Anti-Doping Agency, they voiced their own discontent as well. But first, what do we, these presenters on this podcast, think about this week's decision?
What can I say that won't get us in trouble?
Well, don't start by saying that.
It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't ring true that they have made all the necessary changes, and there's no transparency. We don't actually know on what terms, you know, they've met in order to be able to come back into sport.
Well, that was Callum Skinner's point, wasn't it? The lack of transparency.
He's one of many people who have said that. We don't know what it is that Russia have actually achieved. Apparently, it's what they've significantly not acknowledged their failures. What does that mean? It would be good to have a list of, you know, like almost like a bullet point list of things that Russia have done, and then we can say, all right, fair enough. It looks as though they are rectifying their mistakes and they're moving forwards, but we haven't seen that. It's just all a bit unclear as to exactly, you know, why they've been reinstated. And that, I think that's the issue so many people have, is there's no evidence that anything has changed in Russia. So why should they be reinstated?
Were you surprised by the decision?
I think on the day it was made, no, because there had been people talking about it for the few days before that, and we knew it was happening. But yeah, considering for so long they've had these meetings and they've decided, no, we're not going to reinstate them, they haven't done enough. For them to all of a sudden turn around this time and say, yes, they have done enough, was a bit like, oh, okay. Well, tell us then what they've done and I'll believe it. But no one's told us.
And it looks like this readmission on WADA's part has kind of been in the pipeline for a fair few months now. So you follow what Dan Roan has been doing for the BBC, and he reported that WADA had been looking to reinstate the Russian anti-doping agency as early as May. And something you said to me before we started recording is that a compromise deal was also mentioned in June time. So are we actually that surprised that this is coming about?
I guess if you look at that, no, but I mean, it's still very weird that, you know, how can a country really turn itself around from that, you know, state-sponsored doping program to be completely clean in 3 years? That's a monumental effort if they have. But that, yeah, that compromise letter that was sent by Sir Craig Reedy and the WADA director, Olivier Nigli, was certainly worrying. And it's interesting what Richard McLaren, the man who wrote the McLaren report that was so damning, said. He said, the Russians didn't accept the original conditions, so why would they accept the new ones? Then he said, the Russians drafted the new ones, so they determine their own re-entry rules and the power to interpret them. Does that comment come off the back of that compromise letter that was talked about previously? And if so, doesn't that defeat the whole object of banning them in the first place?
That's the thing with compromise. You said at the start there, how can a country completely transform itself and reinvent itself in the space of 3 years? Not even 3 years, because in November 2015 was when the original ban was put in place. But no one's acknowledged that they have. Everyone has admitted that they've still fallen short. There are compromises left, right and centre, but still they've been reinstated, despite all this fact. All right, they've been reinstated with a few extra factors that have to be taken into consideration. But then that's a sign to everyone, it's a message to everyone, that they haven't fully complied, yet they're still being let back in. Which is one of my main problems with this.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of people's main problems. But the fact is, if this was, for example, Kenya, who have had their own problems in the last few years, they don't have political sway. So they will probably have to, you know, go through all the rules. But the fact is, Russia has a sway on sport. Russia has a sway on the world. They are very, very powerful. There's no denying that. And people, you know, people are fearful of them. People listen to them. People look up to them and respect them. And clearly here, they are using politics, as they did with the whole state-sponsored doping thing in the first place. They're using politics to get themselves back into sport. And, you know, corners maybe have been cut. It's just so difficult to tell because we don't really know what's going on.
Lack of transparency. So the political influence side of things, which I think is probably the key thing here. Look at the IOC, for example, who famously, I think we said they bottled it when they decided not to ban the entirety of Russia for the Olympic Games in Rio and left it up to individual governing bodies to make that decision. They've remained surprisingly, or not surprisingly, quiet throughout all of this. But then you look at the fact that the IOC is a significant funder and contributor to WADA. Sir Craig Reedy is a member of the IOC as well. For the IOC, Russia is a big player, both commercially and politically. Does that influence on the IOC side of things? Maybe, is that the main reason why WADA have made this decision and been forced into that position, perhaps?
It may be so, but it could also be a money thing. You know, Russia has a lot of...
That comes into the commercial side of things.
And Russia has a lot of money and can bring in a lot of money. So perhaps, you know, this compromise would suggest to actually benefit the IOC, not illegally, but in terms of, you know, having Russia at events, makes people more interested. Having Russia at events, hosting events, you know, they can put in a lot of money and make really, really good events. So perhaps there was also that side of it, again, a more of a sway that another country wouldn't have. That could well be something. I'm going to say it again, we just don't know. We literally have no idea, really, do we?
Exactly. One thing that was pointed out, or a comment rather I read on the way in here, is that a lot of the people who are throwing their arms up in the air over this seem to be predominantly British or American. I look at the statement that was put out by the UK Anti-Doping Agency, and in part of that, they said, fundamental questions remain unanswered in respect of the conditions for reinstatement of Russia. Is the LIMS data from the Moscow lab still in existence? Can this data be verified as legitimate and uncorrupted? Will athlete samples needing reanalysis be provided? Will WADA's analysis seek to clarify any evidence of tampering? If the conditions of reinstatement are not met and Russia faces non-compliance, will the goalpost be moved again? Many, many questions that we don't know the answer to, but the fact that only the Americans and British seem to be throwing their arms up in the air, are we the only ones that actually care?
I think there have been other countries whose anti-doping agencies have voiced their opinion and have been unhappy, but I think British and American voices are very, very powerful at the moment in sport. We have so much success on a global scale. I mean, you look at the Olympic tables of recent years, especially the Summer Olympics, American and Britain always at the top or near the top. So I think people listen to us, and we have more money, more power, more influence than a lot of other people. And now they're trying to use that to, you know, get to the bottom of this and sort out what's going on. And we're also interested, like, there's been so much talk in the British and American press about this whole scandal, this whole situation, because, you know, that's not how we do things. It's so alien to us, and we don't like it. So I think we know we have a voice, we know people want to listen to us, and we know people want to listen to our athletes, and we're using that to try and, you know, get to the bottom of this and sort out once and for all, are Russia compliant with the anti-doping?
So what does reinstatement actually mean? Which I think, let's put some bare bones on this, because it's not an automatic guarantee that Russia are going to start competing all of a sudden again. It does pave the way for that, though. It also allows the country to start bidding again for events. We mentioned 2023, the European Championships, before we started recording as well, and there's strong rumours that Russia are going to be bidding for that event. But primarily, it allows the Russian Anti-Doping Agency to test their own athletes and also dish out TUEs by themselves. Worrying, do you think that they're being allowed this? It's the front door key. I consider it. They haven't gone through the front door yet, but they've been handed the access to it. It's kind of how I see it.
My personal opinion is, okay, if you want to allow them to start operating again, fair, but do it under probation, under supervision, and, you know, make sure, at least for the first year or so, that this is all being done to the book, and, you know, that they're not going to slip back into their old ways. I mean, of course, if as soon as you take that supervision away, they could start doing it all over again. But you'd like to think that they wouldn't, that we would be, they'd only walk away, the supervisor would only walk away at a time where we can actually trust them. I think that would be a good start, but whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know.
To continue with my front door analogy, if you want to consider Seb Coe, the president of the IAAF, as someone who's behind the front door with his foot blocking the entrance, then perhaps what he wrote in the Evening Standard this week might give you some sort of idea on that, because he said the IAAF have their own set of criteria for the reinstatement of the Russian Athletics Federation, which we laid out in 2015 when the federation was suspended. The progress against the reinstatement criteria has been overseen by an independent task force chaired by Rune Anderson and including members of the IAAF Council. This process has served us well and allowed us through our own testing measures to enable Russian athletes to compete in international competitions as neutrals. So, say from the athletics side of things, do we see Russia being reinstated under their own flag anytime soon? Or will we see sort of this mishmash at the moment, which we've had for the last couple of years, where you get neutral athletes competing under an Olympic flag or Olympic athletes of Russia, whatever you want to call it this time?
In certain sports, of world championships and European championships, they have been allowed to compete as Russia as well. So
there's no one single decisive line.
That's
to,
been
to
the, as we've both said before. That's been the whole problem the whole time, is that there hasn't been a clear definition of, you know, what they're banned from, who's banning them. It's all been a little bit. No one seems to want to take full responsibility, which is fair enough. You can understand why, for all the various different ramifications. But I think there just needs to be, someone just needs to put the foot down and say, right, these are the rules. They're going to apply to this, 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 and this. Let's go with that.
But there is no consistent policy.
No.
For anyone. Which is, I suppose, a problem when you've got this amount of power, this amount of influence, money, corporatization, dare I say, at the top level. And we it's all fine us saying put your foot down, but it's probably a lot easier said than done.
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. But just this, the whole thing with hindsight could have been handled better by everyone, really.
Here's a question. Is clean sport on the line?
Well, if you ask former GB Paralympic rower Vicky Agar that question, she will give you a quite a blunt answer, as she said earlier this week. She's also a WADA athlete committee member. But before the decision was made, she said that if the wrong unethical decision is made on Thursday, the future of clean sport is on the line. Which is worrying. If an athlete who's competed at the top level thinks that.
Very. From a fan's perspective, which we both are, I also want to ask this question, which I think is probably more important than anything from a fan's perspective. Will we ever trust what we see again?
Do we trust it at the moment? That's the thing. For so many years now, we've been watching sport and we see these amazing performances in certain events, not all events, certain events, and you can't help but think, you know, are they doing that completely unaided? I mean, if you, for example, Formula One, Lewis Hamilton's lap at Singapore in qualifying last weekend was incredible, and no one even thought, oh, he must be on some sort of drugs, because, you know, that doesn't happen in that sport. But then there are certain sports that you can't help but look at an athlete, do something incredible, and think automatically they're doping. We think back to Rio 2016, you had the Ethiopian runner who smashed the record in the 10,000 metres, was in a class of her own, age 19, that no one had massively heard of before, and automatically the suspicion fell on her. But then you look at, you know, marathon runners in recent years from Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, some of the best have since been accused of, investigated for, or even found guilty of taking drugs. You look at sprinting for so many years, so many different drug cheats, hammer throwing, and all those sort of field events as well. It's a sad state that we live in, but I think that's one we're going to have to get used to, is we're just going to constantly question greatness.
Which I think is probably the biggest crime in the entirety of this Russian anti-doping scandal, is that you can look at the moralities of it as much as you like, but it has fundamentally destroyed what we as fans are watching as a spectacle and what we're paying for as
but
a spectacle.
We were also thinking that before this was uncovered. It's just heightened it.
I consider it the final nail in the coffin then. Beforehand, there might have been a chance of it being rectified in some way, but I think if it is ever going to be rectified, in terms of what we're seeing, it's going to take many, many years, possibly many, many decades, if we're ever actually going to reach that point. Which is a sad state of affairs.
Very sad.
But sums up exactly what scandals like this and what individual drug cheats like this, you add that all together and this is the end result. But anyway, moving on to our next topic of discussion, and that is Christina Vogel. She was involved in a full speed crash on June 26th. With a Dutch junior cyclist who was practicing a standing start. And that crash caused her to fracture several vertebrae and she severed her spinal cord. As a result of that injury, she is now being left paralyzed from the waist down. Horrible, horrible news that emerged during the couple of weeks that we were off between recording this episode and the last episode. What was your reaction to hearing the severity of that injury?
I remember when I first read the report of her crash, and the way people were reporting it wasn't good. But I don't think I personally ever thought that it would be that bad. You know, you look at people like Christina Vogel and you look at athletes like that and you think they're invincible. So to actually see something so horrible happen to such an incredible athlete was really shocking. And I saw a video that she put on Instagram the other day of her, you know, getting out of a wheelchair and putting herself on her bed. And I mean, while incredible to watch in that, you know, she's making such positive steps already, it was also, for me, quite hard to watch. You know, this is someone who I took a lot of notice of because she was such a good racer, and, you know, she gave some of our British girls, you know, really, really tough rides. So to see her from being a world champion, you know, Olympic medalist, to go to where she is now was quite difficult to watch. But, you know, her positivity, her attitude, the way she's spoken since has been phenomenal. And I remember when I was lucky enough to speak to Sammy Kinghorn for this podcast, how moved I was by her story. And it's very, very similar with Christina Vogel. You know, the way she's looking at life, the way she's just getting on with it, is inspirational. And, you know, when you think about all the other bad things going on, you know, in your own personal life or anything, you compare it to what she's going through and how positive she's feeling, you know, it puts everything into perspective. And, you know, kudos to her for remaining so positive.
That's the main thing I wanted to highlight, really, in doing this topic. As horrible as it is, and as horrible as the injury is, it's the way she's reacted to it and responded to it. I don't know if people read the piece on BBC Sport that she did, where she said it's okay to cry about the situation and the hand that she's been dealt, but she is tackling it head on. There's no dwelling about what's happened to her. It's all about progress and moving on to the next thing. And if she can't use her legs anymore, then she'll use her arms and she'll use her hands to get about. And like you said, that video on Instagram is a tough watch, considering what she was able to do in the past. She's an Olympic gold medalist after all. But I think it's a lesson for anyone who ever faces adversity, no matter how big or small, is to use Christina Vogel as an example of the bravest, best way to react to things like that. And just by being herself, she is proving to be an inspiration to others, I think.
Like Sammy Kinghorn, they will always be one of life's winners just because of the attitude they have, really.
Like Billy Munger, someone else we've mentioned on this podcast, who also, you know, rising star, such talent, and then suddenly his crash happens and he has his legs amputated. Same way he's bounced back. Just not dwelling in the past in any way, shape or form. There's a lot of similarities between the two, and we have nothing but total and utter respect for people like that, essentially.
And let's just hope, you know, if she wants to, that we one day see Christina Vogel at the Paralympic Games dominating another sport. That's, I think, what we... If she wants to carry on in sport, I think that's what we all want to see from her.
That would be the dream. And with that, we finish up this discussion section on this episode of the podcast. But of course, it is now feature interview time. And to introduce his guest on today's show is Mr. Will Moulton.
Yes, and we have another one of life's winners, an all-round lovely individual, rugby legend, Tamara Taylor. It's a fairly long interview, but it flies by because she's so engaging. We talk about a lot of different things, from ankle surgery to climbing Mount Everest next year, her rugby career so far, her lesser known career as a rugby league international. She played a couple of games for England back in the day, and just the state of the women's game at the moment. We actually spoke just before it was announced the women's 15-a-side team were going to be awarded full-time contracts, but we do speak about, you know, the prospects of contracts in the future. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there. Please do take a listen. She's just fantastic. So welcome back, Sports Fuel listeners, to another feature interview. And I'm delighted to say that today joining me, I've got a bona fide legend of women's rugby in Tamara Taylor. Thank you so much for coming on, Tamara.
Thanks very much for having me, Will.
So you are, well, it's there's so many accolades next to your name. You're the second most capped England player ever, a World Cup winner, multiple Six Nations winner. But we'll get on to all that in a bit. We'll start off, though, with something slightly different. As followers of you on social media would have seen, you have recently signed up for an Everest Exchange Rugby Challenge. So I guess if you could just tell us a little bit more about that and how you got involved.
Yep, so I'm going to be climbing up to just past base camp and attempting to beat the world record for the highest ever game of touch rugby played. So I think we're looking at about 6,500 metres above sea level for that game. And then there'll also be a contact game of rugby going on as well that the boys will be playing in. Yeah, just a walk and then a game of rugby is what I keep telling my staff that it's going to be. But I feel like it's probably going to be a little bit more than that as it becomes more and more real every day.
And how did you get involved with that in the first place?
So it's for a charity called Wooden Spoon, who are a rugby charity. It's based on the name Wooden Spoon, that were formed through that the Five Nations, Six Nations tournament, as it was. And they help disadvantaged and disabled children across the whole country. So it's to raise money for them, and it's being sponsored by LMAX Exchange, which is amazing because they're helping, you know, support such a massive event. And I've played sevens rugby for them. I've been involved as a sort of player ambassador for the charity for a number of years. And it's a charity that I really respect, and I love the work that they do. So I had a phone call from one of the guys telling me about this exciting challenge that was going on, and I was like, oh, that sounds really cool. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, no problem. Without too much detail. And before I knew it, I was signed on the dotted line and reading about exactly what I was going to be doing. So, yeah, my usual kind of just sign up to something and deal with the consequences of it later. I'm now going up halfway up Everest.
Wow, so, certainly one hell of a challenge. And I've seen on social media that some of the captains already look like they've started training. How much effort is going to How physically demanding is this challenge going to be?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anybody watched that Everest documentary on ITV earlier on this week with Ben Fogle and Victoria Pendleton.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was really my moment of, right, you need to make sure that you are getting some miles in your feet, to acclimatise in terms of my body, getting used to walking, because very different walking than it is to playing games of rugby and being as fit as you like. It's a very different type of fitness. And then obviously alongside that is the altitude. So the boys have been posting pictures on our WhatsApp group and videos of how ready they're getting. And I'm still rehabbing from an ankle injury. So walking has only been something I've been doing over the last couple of weeks after getting off crutches and out of a moon boot and a plaster cast. So yeah, they're a couple of steps ahead of me, but I'm hoping that my fitness from the past will at least help me to catch up with them. But it's going to be really, really tough, and it wouldn't be a challenge, you know, worth sponsoring people for if it was really easy. So lots of walking. Hopefully we'll get to go in one of those awful acclimatization chambers where they take away your oxygen, but just, you know, to get used to that really difficult environment.
Well, I wouldn't say it sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds quite hellish, but to be honest. But you mentioned there you've only been walking after ankle surgery for a couple of weeks, and it was quite a big operation that you had on your ankle. Was it something that needed to be done, or was it just the right time to get it done?
A little bit of both. So I've had a reoccurring problem with that ankle, just in terms of the ligament. So lots of people do. I just kept rolling my ankle, going over on it. So the structure was really strong, but I've not had any ligaments kind of keeping everything else in place for a number of years. But because it takes quite a while to rehab from and you're off your feet, it's never really fit into our playing calendar, either internationally or with clubs. So this is the first summer that we've had off and we haven't had a summer tour. So it was kind of the perfect timing, if you like, to have an operation like this. So unfortunately, yeah, it was planned, but it was also pretty much needed. I was hanging on by a couple of threads in my ankle, unfortunately.
And you've been posting on social about your recovery from the surgery, and I found a couple of blog pieces that you'd written about, you know, going into surgery, and it was very honest, and I certainly could sympathise with some of the things you were talking about. Was it quite a cathartic experience? Has that sort of helped you through it?
Yeah, so I've written some more blog pieces, though. I've kept like a bit of a video diary and taken pictures and written down what I've been doing, how I've been feeling. I haven't posted them yet, just because I had a bit of a, as you do on these rehab journeys, it's a real roller coaster ride. And I got pretty down a couple of weeks post operation, and I've written about that that time experience, but I haven't posted it yet. Just want to go back and just look at it and make sure that I'm not just, you know, when you're in a kind of negative frame of mind, sometimes you don't say things exactly as you mean them. So I'm going to look back over all that and then get it online. But I kept a written diary just for myself when I went through knee surgery a few years ago, and that was really important to me because it meant that I could look back on stuff and go, actually, look, you are progressing. Come on. It's very easy to think that you're getting nowhere with your rehab. So I thought this time it would be good to share it with people because a lot of people go through this type of thing, even if it's a different injury. And stuff that I've read from other people, you just feel like you're not alone when you feel down. And when you get super excited that you've put your foot on the ground for the first time, it's nice to be able to share that experience with other people and to see that actually you're not crazy. That is really exciting to put your foot on the ground, which might not seem exciting on a normal day-to-day basis. But yeah, when you've been cooped up in a plaster cast or a moon boot, those little small victories, it's nice to be able to share them with people.
Yeah, and I know for people like myself who've been through surgeries and been through injuries, it's certainly nice to know that even, you know, the top athletes have the same sort of thought processes as us. And have you seen a lot of people who've sort of sympathised and empathised with you on social?
Yeah, I've had a few messages and a few private messages from people just saying, just been lovely, actually, like really supportive, because I think probably I've been honest and it comes across exactly as I felt, you know, nervous and stressed about the nerve block that I had in my foot and I couldn't feel my toes and things like that. So it's been really nice to have people send me messages and say, like, you're doing okay, keep going. Yeah, it just makes you feel like it's good to get the message out there, and it's nice to feel that people are sending you some love back as well.
And as you mentioned, you are still going through rehab and things are progressing. When are you hoping to be back on a pitch? When do we think we'll see you in action again?
That is a very good question. The surgery and everything went really well, according to my consultant. But I'm allergic to lots of things. I've got really sensitive skin, like a little baby. And I was allergic to some of the internal stitches in one of my wounds. So that set me back because I wasn't able to take the dressing off, and I couldn't wear shoes, and I couldn't get in the pool and start my rehab. So I am a little bit behind from that. And I also, you may have seen on social media, I dropped a shelf on my toe about 2 weeks ago, on the same foot. So that stopped me from walking properly and irritated my ankle a little bit just because I couldn't put my weight properly through my foot. So those two small incidences have slowed me down a little bit. So I was set to be back kind of mid-October, November, which is still a sort of target in my head, but I haven't actually run yet. So where are we? First of September, and I still haven't run. So I'm starting to push those markers a little bit. So we'll see. Definitely, I'm saying this now, definitely before Christmas. And hopefully I'll still keep to that kind of October time frame, which is one fingers crossed for.
And obviously coming back before Christmas will mean hopefully you'll get to see plenty of action in the Tyrrell's 15s and second season of that starting later this month. What did you make of the first season? There was a lot of coverage on Sky. There was a lot of talk about it. Was it as positive and as impressive as everyone thought it was going to be?
Well, I hope so. For the people that have seen it and, you know, see it grow, we had a fantastic premiership that's been running for, I don't even know how many years, years and years and years, that a lot of those teams played in. And what the Tyrrell's Premiership has done is raise the profile of that competition, added a couple more teams. Obviously, the RFU have put a major investment into those 10 teams in terms of finances and support. And that's made a huge difference to the teams. And, you know, some of the clubs needed to put a little bit extra on their coaching or their medical or their facilities. And they've been able to do that by those extra funds, which in turn increases the level that the girls at those clubs are playing and training at, which is, you know, it's only going to be good for the game in terms of the players. and hopefully we'll get a few more games streamed this year, a couple more games on TV, and you know, there's no reason that it's not going to go from strength to strength every year as it grows in popularity.
And you talked about their games being streamed and on TV, and you know, there was quite a few on YouTube and on Sky, and there seems to be a lot more people just talking about women's rugby. Is that something you as players noticed as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the support we've had media-wise, and then the fact that the clubs are being pushed and challenged by the RFU to really promote themselves meant that it's going out across all levels. It's coming from the players themselves, their clubs, England Rugby. Everybody's kind of jumping on the bandwagon. And I think you only know that something's there and it's available to you, like women's rugby, if it's visible. You can't know something that you can't see. So the more we can get our thoughts out there in social media and, you know, on TV and on the radio and get that buzz around, and the more interest we're going to generate from a spectator point of view, commercially, but also from a player point of view, so that girls can see that actually one day there's going to be a rugby playing job out there for them as a woman, which is, I think, is huge in terms of growing the game and raising people's ambitions.
Of course, and in terms of growing the game, English rugby, women's rugby has soared, certainly in the last few years. But I think it's fair to say sort of the team is going through a little bit, the 15s team is going through a bit of a transition with certain retirements recently, the likes of Daniel Waterman, Rocky Clark, Izzy Noel-Smith and Kay Wilson. And how crucial is it to have a top quality league to help keep producing the talent and help you guys keep up and keep improving with the likes of France and New Zealand and Australia?
Yeah, definitely. And sort of, I touched on it before, the better standard that we get at club rugby, the more supportive that is to the England selection. We have always had those players coming through, and now those players are getting more support from their clubs, which should mean that they should, you know, have a better level of understanding of game understanding, better strength and conditioning and fitness levels, just purely because, you know, there's more finances around those clubs. And although the players aren't professional at a club level, I think the work that they're putting in is, you know, professional with a small p, or however you want to call that, and that's going to drive the standard of England, because there's only a limited amount of time as an international that you work alongside the international coaches. The real work and, you know, where these talents are grown and that your skills are honed is at club rugby. For a major part of our lives at the moment as non-professional players, so it's really important that the Tyrrells Premiership is driven forwards and that those clubs are driving it forwards.
Of course, and in terms of driving forwards and producing those players, last season already we saw a whole host of young international, well, future international stars bursting through in that league, such as Jess Breach, Ellie Kildun and Abigail Dowers. And from the outside, it seems that, you know, English rugby really is moving forwards, and there's a lot of good players coming through. Is that a correct assumption from us?
Yeah, and I think probably what's nice is that there's publicity around it now, and, you know, those three especially have, as you said, burst onto the scene. But I think every year we've reaped the rewards of the community game, the universities, the schools, the county, with girls starting to play rugby younger, get better training, better competition levels, because there's more rugby being played at the community level, and those girls are coming through those ranks. And we've also got the England pathway and the under 20s, and those girls are really coming through as well. And I think we've always had a good crop of young players coming through each time. You know, it's never loads, but that's how these things work. You get a couple in, and that, you know, they're the top, and then a few more come through. You had Zoe Allcroft and Sarah Byrne the year before that, and we've had Emily Scarrett coming through, Amy Cocaine, who everybody thinks is about 35, but she's actually only really young, playing well above her years. So, yeah, we have always had those young players coming through, but what's great is the publicity now around the game and the buzz that's really pushing those young girls to the forefront.
And is it, I imagine it must be pretty good for you as well, having this crop of players coming through, because it keeps you on your toes and makes you guys work even harder and get stronger as an entire unit.
Yeah, you know, every position, every team, you've got to have challenges. you know, from above and from below, that's the only way you grow as a team, is to never be complacent and never feel that your place, either as a team in the league or, you know, in international rankings, or as a player in your position, you can't ever feel safe, because if you feel safe, that's when you start taking your eye off the ball and your foot off the gas a little bit. So it's great that rugby is growing from grassroots all the way up through the pathway, because it's going to just keep pushing the top level higher and higher and higher.
And it's interesting that you say there that, you know, you never quite feel safe as a player, because you yourself have won 115 caps, England's second most capped player ever, behind Rocky Clark. And I just want to touch on that moment where you became the second highest capped player earlier this year. And I just wanted to sort of ask you how it felt, you know, obtaining that achievement.
It's quite a difficult one, actually, because it was arguably our most important game of the season. France away, Six Nations hanging in the balance game, and that just happened to be my 115th cap, which was the record-breaking one. And not a lot of people knew that my milestone was coming up, because all the focus was, rightly so, around the fact that it was us in France against France and the Six Nations. So it was quite a quiet accolade, really, that I had, which, you know, the important part really is the game. That's why we're there. That's why I got my 115th cap, because it was to try and beat France in France. And I think it's probably not something that I'll really get excited about and until I can look back on it. Because at the time, you know, the game overshadowed it, and obviously the result, I was absolutely devastated. So I'd have given back a load of those caps to have won that game, 100%. It was, you know, it's really difficult beating France in France. And I haven't done it in a while, and I was absolutely desperate to win that game. So, yeah, I think I'll look back on it and be really proud, but at the moment it's still a little bit raw with the result, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's entirely fair enough. But just sticking with you personally, when you first started playing rugby, did you ever think you'd achieve, you know, what you have in the game?
Definitely not. I don't think anyone ever really knows or thinks that they're going to become the second most capped England player. The reason I started playing rugby is because my brother played, and it looked like a really cool game that girls weren't really supposed to be playing. So I thought, I'm going to give that a shot. That looks really good. My brother plays it. And I was an absolute annoying little sister that just followed him everywhere and wanted to do everything that he did. And that's why I played, because I loved it. It was different. It wasn't like any other girls' sport that I'd played before. And that's why I kept doing it, because I loved it. And I think it's very hard to keep doing a sport if you fall out of love with it. And that's what's kept me going, is that I do think it's one of the greatest sports that you can ever play. And I think it's such a huge opportunity of something different for girls to play. And it's such a good game for all different shapes and sizes. So inclusive, yeah. So just loved it from the start, and that's really what's kept me going.
And you say you loved it from the start. I think I remember rightly reading somewhere that you also played rugby league for England while you were studying at university. But was there ever a choice between the two, or was it always going to be rugby union for you?
So the only reason really that I played rugby league was a couple of the girls who played in the uni team, their boyfriends were playing in the men's rugby league side, and they were like, oh, why don't we have a women's team? So a couple of us went along and had a couple of games, had absolutely no idea what I was doing, still trying to lay the ball back at the breakdown, and there wasn't a breakdown, and trying to rip the ball and offload, and, you know, all the things that rugby union has that rugby league doesn't. I was trying to do them all, and then from that I got selected into a GB students team, and then before I knew it, we were on a trip to Russia alongside the England under-20s girls, who all knew what they were doing. And there was a couple of us from my university who were older than the under-20s, but literally still trying to play rugby union on a rugby league pitch, learning the rules as we went along, where we were allowed to grab on a collar in a tackle, which you're not allowed to do in union. It was a massive learning curve, but I think it was really good for my game, because although they're both rugby, there's real differences between them in terms of how you ball carry and how you defend. And I think it really helped me with a leg drive to get through that contact, and also the confrontational nature of the defence. You just straight up in a line relentlessly in rugby league. So your tackling has to be absolutely on point, and you've got to try and drive people back. So I think it definitely added to my union game. But I love all the stuff that goes with union. I love the fact that they're set piece and not everyone's the same size, and you can offload out of a tackle, and there's a contest for possession at the breakdown, and, you know, all over the pitch. I love that side of it, where you don't really know who's going to have the ball at any point, and it can change. So, yeah, there was never really going to be any arguments between league and union for me personally.
And you speak really passionately there about union. Is your passion for the game still as strong now as it ever has been, or is it perhaps even grown across your career?
I think it changes as you go along. The game as a whole, I love, and you know, my job is I'm a rugby coach, so I'm obviously passionate about it, because it's very difficult to coach something that you're not passionate about.
Very true.
And I think that it's definitely something that for boys and girls, especially who've never played before, when I see how much of a difference it makes to those kids that don't necessarily participate in other sports, because maybe they're a bit bigger than the other kids, or they don't think they're as fit or as agile, there's a place for them. Or the really little ones, there's a place for them as well, because they're going to have good footwork, because they've got to stay away from the big kids. So I don't think it has changed, because I'm going more towards coaching than playing now. Just, you know, I'm getting older a little bit. So that side of it changes. And sometimes I think as you get older, you lose a little bit of that kind of childhood, this is just fun, let's just do it for fun. And you start playing internationally, and suddenly it's not always fun, because the training's really hard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's not fun. And the results or the selection or the injury, those bits, they taint you a little bit. And what I've had to do over the last couple of years is keep trying to remind myself why I started playing and what it is that I love about the game, because I think sometimes you can lose that in a sort of professional environment.
Yeah, of course. And speaking of a professional environment and the fact that you say you currently coach at the moment, we were lucky enough last year on the podcast to speak to Marley Packer before the World Cup, at a time when you were training full time. And how was that period for you? Was it quite a bit of a culture shock compared to what you were used to?
Yeah, definitely. I was used to having to try and fit in full-time training, in training 6 days out of seven alongside full-time work. And that's just how I'd been. That's how I'd functioned for probably 11 years of my life. So for somebody to say, look, we're going to pay you the amount that you were getting paid in your last job, but we want you to train the same as you have been training, plus a little bit more, you know, because you've got more time now, and then I want you to rest in between times. I was like, what are you saying to me? This is amazing. So yeah, that I'll forever be grateful that I was given the opportunity to be a professional athlete. You know, I'd have bitten your hand off to be any kind of an athlete and be paid to do the sport that I love, definitely. And to be able to do it for even such a short period of time of 8 months was just amazing, to be able to say that my job is a rugby player, and that I can actually devote all my time to trying to be a better rugby player and to be fitter and faster and stronger, and, you know, all the different things that you need as a rugby player. It was just really amazing, and I'm really glad that I got that opportunity. It did, however, make it horrific in September when I went back to work, because I'd done it for how many years, but when you've had that taste of the good life, it was really difficult going back to doing what I'd been doing for so long. That made it really tough. It's like when you've gone on a really nice holiday and then you have to come back to reality. Yeah. It's a little bit of a feeling like that.
Yeah, I think we can all empathise with that. And there was a lot of talk at the time when the contracts weren't renewed for the 15-a-side team. But was that something you, as players, sort of knew was coming, or was it a bit of a disappointment that you weren't going to carry on being full time?
No, I think, to be honest, the only people that didn't know that that was happening was the media. So when we were given the opportunity of the contracts, we knew as a forward I was only going to be contracted from January to August. Some of the girls that had come from seventh or were in the backs were contracted from September, so for the whole season. But most of the forwards only joined in January. But we knew that that's what it was. We knew it was a short-term contract. We knew that we'd all be going back to work come September post World Cup. So I think everybody got pretty flustered about it in terms of the media, but we already knew it was happening. Mm-hmm. We signed it in that knowledge, and there's very few people that would have turned down that opportunity with it only being short time, because how could you turn down an opportunity like that? And yeah, we'd love it to go on, and we would all have loved to have stayed as professional athletes, but we were fully aware that it was going to come to an end and that the funding wasn't, you know, forever at that time.
I guess though that the fact that people were and are talking about it must show how much the game has grown and how much the status of women's rugby has grown in this country in a very short space of time.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that there's the attention around it, and that people were genuinely concerned and saddened and upset by the fact that we weren't going to be continuing with our contracts. And that, you know, people may have thought it in the past, but they maybe didn't know that these kinds of things were going on, and they didn't know how great the England women's rugby team had been performing, and, you know, all the great stuff that's gone on in the years and years before, and the teams and the players that have come before that just haven't had the same publicity and haven't had the same media interest, and yet they've all done the same as, you know, they've fought the same fight that we fought over the years. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice, and I think it's for them as well that have gone before, that there's now interest in it, because they forged this path for us, and hopefully we've forged a path for the next generation of players, so that actually one day we will be fully contracted and it'll be the same as the boys, that you are a rugby player and that's your job.
Was there a particular moment when you as players noticed a real change in the media attitude and the publicity surrounding your game, or has it been a gradual process?
And I think when you're in it, it's sometimes quite hard to see it, because you're just living it every day and you think about it and you talk about it. So it's just there. And sometimes when you've been injured or you step outside of that box or you speak to other people, you realise that actually it has escalated at a huge pace, especially over the last few years. And I know definitely the Olympics in 2012 made a huge difference to women's sport, and having it on TV and having all the different sports just freely available for people to watch, men and women. I really think that started it in this country, started the ball rolling, and then luckily we won the World Cup in 2014, which kind of just bumped up a bit more momentum there. And there's been a load of projects for, you know, women's rugby and girls rugby specifically at grassroots level that have also increased that momentum. And the playing numbers have grown massively. The spectator figures are growing every time. You know, the World Cup last year in Ireland again had more people watching it and more people tuning in. And, you know, the final was on live on ITV, I think, with 2 million people watching. And it's, yeah, if you actually stop and you get some of the figures, it's definitely been kind of snowballing since then. And I think that's why this really is the time to invest in women's sport, not just rugby, but women's sport in general. It is about to get over the edge of the cliff and just go for it. So if you're a sponsor, get in there right now.
Fantastic words. And you talk about, you know, the merging of men and women's rugby in a previous answer, and we saw the fantastic news this week that as of today, the 1st of September, the men's and the women's sevens teams will be working alongside each other down in Teddington. How positive a step is that for both teams, really?
I'm not part of the squad, so I wouldn't want to speak on their behalf, but I know the girls have really benefited from the training that they've done alongside the men, and you know, a couple of the boys are doing player coach roles, and they've been doing some coaching with the girls, and their knowledge and experience, you know, some of the guys there, Rodders has been playing for probably nearly as long as I have, and their experience is absolutely fantastic to be shared alongside those girls, some of whom haven't been playing sevens as long as the guys. So it's a massive help in terms of their learning and their skill set. And also the pace of the game. I know when the girls trained with the boys, as in, you know, against them and did some semi-opposed stuff, you have to run faster and you have to think quicker because you're playing against people who are running faster than you. Therefore allowing them a little bit more time to be able to think and, you know, react to decisions. So it will be really, really good for the girls, and I think it will be really good for the boys to have a different viewpoint on things, and those girls bring a completely different skill set to some of the guys, and, you know, maybe they're not as stuck in their sevens ways, and I think you can always learn from other people, other sports, different points of view. So I think it'll, personally, looking from the outside, I think it'll be massively positive. It's just going to take a bit of time for the girls to get used to the relocation. I know that's been quite a difficult point for them, moving from Bisham Abbey, where they've set their homes up now, across into London, basically, to the Lensbury.
Well, I know we'll certainly miss having them around at Bisham. But going back, it's not just exciting news for the sevens teams at the moment. The Quilter Autumn Internationals were also announced for the 15-a-side squad yesterday. Three games, quite an exciting series in prospect. Something for us to look forward to as fans?
Definitely, yeah. I'm really excited that they've finally been announced and everyone can jump on the bandwagon and book their tickets and get themselves down to the games if they can. And what's really nice about this series is that it's moving around. You know, they're not just in London. We've got the middle game, I think it is, up in Doncaster at Castle Park, which will just be amazing. You know, I'm obviously a southerner, but I'm living in the north, and I'm a massive advocate for trying to get international sport, whatever it is, just a bit further north, just a little bit further up, so that it can be more easily accessible to people. So I've had loads of messages from people so excited that there's a game in Doncaster. It's not even the north, really, for the people that are further up. But, yeah, people are just booking their tickets already and getting behind it and excited that it's moving between London, obviously North London with Allianz, and then up to Doncaster.
And you say people are booking their tickets. I know Alistair and I have already got ours for the first game. And is this another fantastic opportunity for people to join the hashtag Show Up campaign and, you know, really promote women's sport and go and watch something they've never seen before?
Yes, 100%. I was really lucky to go along to the hockey using that hashtag Show Up campaign, and also the women's golf as well. And I think as sports people, we, especially sports females, we really need to start, you know, putting our money where our mouth is in terms of showing up to these events. And I learned so much sitting there on a very sunny day watching hockey. I've not really watched a lot of hockey. I certainly haven't watched it live. And it was an amazing atmosphere. It was absolutely fantastic. Being at a World Cup event, being at an international, just amazing. So we're definitely going to get ourselves out and about to more supporting each other as sports people. And yeah, I'd just say to anybody that's thinking of going out and watching some sport, just come down and watch and you won't be disappointed. Definitely won't be disappointed.
And I think that is the perfect message to end this interview on. Thank you so much, Tamara. And we'll quickly dive back to where we started the interview, talking about your Everest challenge. First of all, best of luck for that. And for us people, you know, who wants to get involved and maybe sponsor or donate some money, how can we do that? Where do we need to go?
So there's lots of ways that you can donate. You can either go onto my Virgin Money giving page, which is just Virgin Money giving / Tamara Taylor. You can do sponsored events at your schools or your clubs or your homes. You can climb your own Everest and donate the money through, get yourselves on the Wooden Spoon website as well, and you can donate directly there, or you can become a sponsor. So you can sponsor parts of the event, you can sponsor kit, you can sponsor me, you can sponsor some of the other participants. So yeah, there's loads and loads of ways, and I would love to get you involved in such a great challenge.
Awesome. And just to double check, when's exactly is it happening?
We leave on the 13th of April and get back, all being well, as champions on the 6th of May.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you for such a fantastic interview. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope the listeners have too. Thank you, Tamara.
Thanks for having me, Will. Cheers.
Thanks once again to Tamara for coming onto the show. I'm sure everyone else enjoyed that interview as well. I know you certainly did, across the table, he says, nodding his face. Nodding his head. Oh, it's one of those days. Anyway, before we wrap up and get out of this sort of play school environment we've somehow ended up in, I hope that hasn't come across on the audio. But as ever, we will point people in the direction of our social media pages. We are on Twitter, we are on Facebook, we are on Instagram, we're also on LinkedIn, if people are into that LinkedIn kind of thing.
And YouTube.
Oh, and YouTube, we're on that too. All of our handles are SportsBuildPod, so you can search for that and you will find us. You can also send us emails, whatever is on your mind, feedback, to our email address, which is sportsbuildpod@gmail.com. And we also have a website, which is our home for everything, both audio and written. That is sportsbuildonline.com. Next episode, for those that have been keeping count, is very, very special. And why is it special?
Because it's our 50th!
It is our 50th. Ignore the fact that this is called episode 28, because with all of our regular episodes and our special episodes, today is the 49th, the next one is the 50th. And we had something very, very special planned for it.
We do. Alistair has conducted an interview with an as yet unnamed guest, but a true legend, not just of their sport, but of sport in general. It's an hour-long interview. I haven't heard it yet, but I'm very, very excited to, and you should be too, because this person is a very, very good talker. And very interesting.
Took the words right out of my mouth. So we will be revealing who that is on social media throughout the course of the week, because we will be releasing that special episode. So there'll be no discussion section, it'll just be a one-on-one interview on the 30th of September. So that is 1 week's time. So make sure you subscribe and tune in for all of that. We will be back, the two of us, on the 14th of October, which will be 2 weeks after the 50th is released. However, because it's the 50th, and we're a half century, I think, of episodes, is a good place to have a little look at ourselves, rebrand, revamp, think about things we can do a little differently. We're going to revamp the podcast a little bit, both in terms of design, the way we do it, music, the structure, all that sort of stuff. But it'll be full on sport and plenty of interviews, just like always.
And don't worry, we'll still be here.
We will still be here. So yeah, if people want to take part in that as well, if you want to send us an email to the aforementioned email address about what you'd like to see, what you don't want to see, please get involved and send us some emails. That is it for us this week. Let's get out of this play school environment. And so until our next outing, next week, the 30th of September, have fun, everyone. Bye-bye for now.